One of the things I miss about parish work is every week having to work on a new text, getting ready to preach on something and teach on something, because I always found that it challenged me to think and all that. So in my administrative work these days, there's not as much of that. So when I get a chance to have somebody say, here, take these chapters and do something, I'm like, oh, good. This is like, you know, good exercise, good workout. So today, we're obviously talking about this book, The Divine Dance by Richard Rohr. Before we get into it, I want to do a little Akasa piece. This last Sunday, some of you were there because we celebrated, for those of you who knew Stephanie Glatt, we celebrated 40 years of Stephanie working at La Casa, and we had a wonderful experience there. Very grateful for all the things going on at La Casa. We've got a big environmental project, a big water grant that we got from the state. We're working on a lot of nonprofit leadership things, particularly with immigrant leaders in the LA area, and just a lot of stimulating things. La Casa has been a place for so many great things over the years, and so we're trying to keep that flag going. And then also, a lot of you know there's this amazing place at La Casa, which I didn't really know much about for many years. The Center for Spiritual Renewal. How many of you know about the Center for Spiritual? Okay, great. So it's just an extraordinary stone manor house. It's got a great history, and it's just one of the most remarkable three-dimensional realities there is in the world. So I bought some of the brochures and things, but it's truly, especially as we're coming to the holiday times, and you think, what should I do for somebody, a friend or a family member, or, you know, for my own family or something, or, you know, a partner in me? Really think about going to La Casa, giving that as a gift certificate or something, going to the Center for Spiritual Renewal. Because what happens there is people's lives get renewed and issues get resolved and made clear, and the grace of God is so tangible there. So anyway, just putting a little pitch in for that wonderful place, and I'll put that out there. Okay, so going on to the Trinity, Tom was telling me that his wife did some of the artwork on the opening session. I'm sorry? On iconography? Right, yeah. So I'm not sure an expert in any of this, but it's always interesting. The Trinity is a pretty fascinating challenge. And so to think about how people have tried to visualize it, and that's certainly one. And another one, perhaps this one, Anne, that you shared, this one, the trifacial Trinity. You know, how do you express three persons in one? And then you move on. Dante, I'll end the day with a reading from the end of Dante's Divine Comedy. But at the end of Dante's great journey through the spiritual realities of life, ends up at the top of paradise, and there sees these circles and this rainbow-like effect and this light that we'll kind of read at the end. And this was actually done by an English kind of a woodcutter, a draftsman printer back in the early 1800s, of trying to imagine three circles within each other and kind of a human form at the middle. Another way that's been portrayed, Gustave Doré did a kind of a very famous one of Dante kind of staring at the ultimate reality beyond all of earthly reality. But when we get to our time, it's interesting to find which of these art pieces, do any of them work for us anymore? I'm sure I've shared at least once or twice that in a Bible study I did in my Santa Paula church many years ago, we were talking about the kingdom of God or something, and one woman said, I think you've maybe heard me say this, one woman said, you know, I'm mad at the astronauts. And I said, what are you mad at the astronauts for? Well, they went up there and they didn't see heaven. And I don't know where it is anymore, you know? So in the modern era of, really from Galileo, but certainly now with the Hubble telescope and all of that, when we try to conceptualize heavenly things, spiritual things, it's, how do we do that? It's an interesting challenge. And obviously for Richard Rohr and many others, this particular piece He says it's just become, it's grown in its life, its life-giving quality to him. And the sense of the three figures of the Trinity kind of sharing a common presence and a mutuality around this common bowl. And that the Jesus in the center there has got two fingers on the table, the human and the divine qualities. And the Spirit over here on the left is kind of pointing to an area that might have had a little mirror on it so that we see ourselves in it. And as all of you have read the book, know that for Rohr, this just really speaks deeply to him about, instead of a highly hierarchical kind of a concept, this is very, very much a divine dance, very much something that we're invited to be part of and not just keep off in the distance. So, there's the fingers. So I was assigned, Anna gave me a slip of paper, here's your assignment. So for those chapters, I'm just going to kind of do maybe a thought from each one as we go through it. At the beginning of the book, he talks to, this seems to be a fundamental theme for him, talking about the Trinity has traditionally been transactional and propositional, but not relational and mysterious. And that it can be very clearly, cognitively worked out in deep philosophical theories, but it can be kind of dry. And for him, it's this real call to rediscover a very relational and a mysterious, an experience, something we can experience in this Trinitarian life. For primal prayer, he talks, it's a big emphasis, of course, is prayer, that we spend too much time trying to decide things up in our rational mind. And in terms of prayer, we're really deepening ourselves in that, that we don't do that to wait for a future state. The state of full grace is really available to us now. If the more we grasp this Trinitarian flow that's right, accessible to us. He says we have a transcendence deficit disorder. And it's because, in a sense, perhaps, that there was a time when the sense of the divine was way, way up there. And then there was a time in the 60s and 70s, perhaps, when it got really kind of came down to earth. I remember, I didn't grow up in the church, so it was new to me, but I remember going to a communion service somewhere where they said, we can just use Kool-Aid. And this, it wasn't Jim Jones. It was, you know, nothing. But it was, you know, it was just like, oh, let's not get hung up on these things. Let's just get right down to earth. And to not be so formal and everything. And as he points out, and I certainly appreciate this, if things get too flat and easy and easily accommodated, we really lose something. I remember Abraham Joshua Heschel, the great Jewish scholar, said, God is not a kind uncle. God is an earthquake. You know? And there's some, when we really encounter the divine, it shakes us up. And that's a biblical concept, and it can happen in our personal lives. So I think, with Rohr, that we don't want to make God too chummy and easy. We'll miss the awe, lose what makes us kneel. What is it that really makes us want to kneel? We need to keep transcendence while we focus on immanence. So we do want to bring God close in this Trinitarian dance, but we don't want to make it so prosaic and easy and convenient that we lose that sense of awe and transcendence. Now, this one I'm not quite so sure of. He talked about interfaith friendship, and he said, once Christians learn to honor a cosmic Christ as a larger ontological identity, like reality, than the historical Jesus, then other faiths have no reason to be afraid of us. And I just, you know, I've done a fair amount of work with Jewish and Muslim congregations in my pastoral time and since then. And I just don't think it's that easy. I think, you know, for Muslims, of course, they feel Jesus is a great prophet, but there's some real separation between what we would say who Jesus is and what Muslims say. And for all Jews, I mean, that Jesus might have been a great rabbi, but he certainly wasn't the Son of God. And just to make him into a cosmic Christ that's everywhere, in other words, the Jews are experiencing him, but they don't know it. Most of the rabbis I know who I love to spend time with, I don't think they wouldn't really buy that. So I understand what he's trying to go for. In fact, I was in Santa Fe a couple of years ago at the Spiritual Directors International, and Richard Rohr was speaking. And there was actually a number of Jewish tables there. And at one point, he kind of said, And you know, for us, the incarnation, that's our trump card. Forgive the word. They didn't mean that then. But you know, that's our real way. That's what we've got, a kind of an upper hand. He didn't mean it in a bad way, but I remember seeing the Jewish folks at the table kind of shift a little bit. If you really want to do interfaith work, you don't want to give up what you're deeply rooted in. But don't presume that you can rearrange other people's understanding. So I didn't quite go with Rohr, what he said in Santa Fe. I didn't quite go with him here, but that's okay. So then he says, do we have to talk about sin? He says, what sin? Well, it stops the flow. We're supposed to be experiencing this Trinitarian dance, but sin is what kind of interrupts that, blocks us off from the divine energy. And then he quotes this prayer, God for us, we call you Father. God alongside us, we call you Jesus. God within us, we call you Holy Spirit. So the divine energy is for us, it's alongside us, and it's within us. And so there's this sense of, sin blocks that awareness and blocks that openness that we have to participate in that. And then he says, entering by another door. Ultimately, we know God not by the mind, but by through the door of prayer. So for him, it's really it takes good thinking, but it ultimately is kind of a passageway through the heart. I think a couple years ago, you all had Michael Carney, the hospice physician. Michael's such a great thinker and wonderful, wonderful physician. And, you know, in the hospice world, he often talked about when a patient is struggling with things, and then they drop into the heart. And there's a time and a process, sometimes in an illness, where they drop into the heart, and some of the anxious thoughts, that ways of trying to understand things, dissipate, and the person goes to a deeper place, that dropping into the heart. And it doesn't mean the mind is disconnected, but it means we're centering ourselves in something deeper than just the rapid succession of our thoughts. So I think that's what Rohr is saying here, that ultimately through that door of prayer, through a deeper, more holistic openness to God, then we can really experience it all. And he says being there. God's already here. God's not waiting somewhere for us to summon God. God is very close to us. Early on in my life, when I was getting to know Christian faith, and I had been so skeptical of it, and then when I was discovering it, one of the phrases that always meant so much to me is when Jacob wakes up in the morning after his dream and says, God was in this place and I did not know it. God was in this place and I did not know it. And often we can go into a situation and maybe not be sure quite how whether is God are there or not, but we can often find ways in which we end up saying, wow, I mean, I have said God was in that place. I didn't know it at the time. So God is already there. It's up to us to catch up with that reality. And he says there's an amazing chain of being. And this one I'm not quite so sure of when he said this. He quotes Jesus saying, anyone who welcomes you welcomes me. Anyone who welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me. And Rohr says, this means there is a moral equivalence between you, your neighbor, the Christ, and God. Will you allow this to be true? I'm like a moral equivalence. I don't know. There's a flow that Jesus is talking about, a connection, a deep oneness maybe, but a moral equivalence. So these are my little notes on the side as I'm reading. I'm like, oh, I don't know about that. But I think he's really wanting to emphasize this deep, this open process that the divine life's all about. So my larger response after reading the book and the section I was assigned, to be honest, it was hard for me to grasp what he was saying. I felt like there were a lot of puzzle pieces on the floor, and I had to go around and kind of assemble them myself. It was, you know, I guess because I'm kind of sometimes a linear kind of when I want to follow somebody's way of thought. And I just kept thinking, well, now what's he saying? And so I'd go to different parts, and I'd go to different parts. Anyway, that was just my experience. Makes me think too, Kierkegaard, the great Danish philosopher, theologian, said, you know, whenever we talk about God and the reality of God, we should always have a little smile on the corner of our face, because it's really kind of presumptuous. that we're it's fine if we do that, but just have a little sense of self-humor that we would aspire to define things that are going to be so far beyond us. And I think about that a lot. I mean, I love to talk about these kinds of things, but the ultimate reality, I'm going to have a little smile. Kierkegaard also said when you talk about God, it's like having a thorn in your hand. You want to hold it. You want to hold it and look at it, but you don't want to grasp it because then it'll kind of get you. So this sense of respect, you know, this sense of dutiful respect. And for me, I guess the big question is the Trinity and ontology on the one hand versus accommodation and experience on the other. So by ontology, that wasn't a word I learned till I was in seminary, I think, or at least in philosophy. But that's like the ultimate, that's what really is really real, 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 real. And to know what ontologically is true is to say that is the fundamental truth that is indisputable. So with the Trinity, ontologically, it's interesting, and I'm going to kind of go through this, some thoughts about it. But I think about accommodation. John Calvin uses the term accommodation, and it's that God accommodates to our level of understanding. So as Calvin pointed out, that if I just got a new little grandson, so when I walk in to see him, he's 6-7 weeks now, I don't say, "Well, how was your day? How are things going?" I go, hey, how you doing? Who? You know, I accommodate to his level of understanding, and hopefully I'll get a little eye open up or something. But we instinctively do that, you know, to pets, to babies. And what Calvin is saying is that the language that we receive, the images we receive, we need to remember there are accommodations to us. There's a deep, who knows, really, there's a deep, extraordinary, perhaps way beyond us reality out there. But the scripture and our life is all about what can we have that works for us, you know, that accommodates to our level of understanding, whatever that is. And then thinking versus singing. I had a strange experience when I was working on Rohr's book. He was talking a lot about the communal dance and everything. And I started, and I'm not a musician, I wish I was, or a singer, but I started hymning the hymn, "O Worship the King, O Glorious Above." You know that one? "Oh, worship the King." And I thought, God, I was walking around just singing it on my morning walk, and I thought, well, that's pretty hierarchical. You know? But I thought about how much I love that hymn. And it really made me think. On the one hand, conceptually, I really am drawn to this communal kind of thing, but there's something instinctive for me of kind of hierarchical majesty. Now, maybe Rohr would say, oh, I'm missing the point here. But I'm going to ask you after our break, one thing I'd be kind of fun to talk about is what hymns speak to you about God as creator or father and Jesus and spirit. My sense is that in most hymn books, the Presbyterian hymn book, the spirit, for instance, not a lot of hymns about spirit, mostly God and Jesus. But anyway, we can kind of explore that. But if those of you who love music and hymns, please be thinking about that. Anyway, so as I was working on this, I think, what am I going to say? Gosh, what am I going to say in that morning at Word and Life? And I started thinking about my own little journey, and I started thinking about how have I experienced the Trinity at different stages in my life's way. So I'm going to kind of take you along a little bit, and it's because it was interesting to me when I did that. I was marking down in my 40 years, my 40-year journey, you know, where have I experienced Trinity? So, that's the question I'm going to pose right now, and be thinking about your own journey. The similar themes come up. So, as Anna read, I was a student at UCSB, and did not grow up in the church at all, didn't know a hymn, maybe knew a few Christmas carols. Grew up in a very secular time, a very, the university taught to be very skeptical and to love Nietzsche and philosophy, and don't even try to get the truth, just try to get a really good method going. That's what you'll get a PhD for, is a good method. And I kind of bought into that and really went on that big journey. Didn't realize, in retrospect, for those of you know the myth of Icarus, gets his waxen wings and just really wants to see how high he can fly. And for me, my time at the university, I tried to ascend as high as I could in abstract, daring, intellectual thought. And as I did so, I got more and more socially isolated. I was very sociable in high school, but as I went through my university time, it's sobering to think of how I became more and more withdrawn. But I was convinced that I was getting up somewhere really high with some great knowledge. And then that all came to an end, in a sense. Being the 70s, the things that were available, the drugs and stuff that were available, that was part of that journey of being enlightened and seeing truth that nobody had seen before and everything. I ended up having a really not so good experience on one particular day that was quite harrowing. And then, so that was my Icarus, fell down. And it is as if the mind that I had trusted in and took such pleasure in, and pride, had led me way beyond where life was. And so that one summer of 1973, I entered a very difficult time. And that summer was getting panic attacks and things. I didn't know that's what they were at the time. But kind of on the run, just emotionally and all that. Back in San Bernardino, it's got a little smog in it. That's where I grew up. And one evening in early September, I was at my house. My folks were in San Clemente. Nobody else was around. A buddy of mine, a neighbor, was gone. So I was kind of alone. And I was trying to go to sleep and to get up for work the next day. And I started having one of these panic attacks come. And really kind of felt, this time it was like, I'm not going to make it. I'm not going to make it. So, a couple days later, I was painting an apartment building in San Bernardino, acoustic ceiling, 2-inch nap roller, I can still remember it. And I suddenly realized that something had happened to me, that there was a little bit of peace in me. And suddenly, I remembered this trauma that I'd been experiencing that Sunday evening. And I was like, wow, I was really losing it. What happened? And I thought, I know what happened. I prayed. Now, I was an atheist at the time. So I don't know what I prayed. I mean, I remember thinking I prayed the Lord's Prayer. I have no idea if it would have sounded like the Lord's Prayer to anybody who knew it. But I learned just enough, maybe in some little Sunday school class, that that's what I'd prayed. So that when I was painting that ceiling, and I stopped and I thought, wow, I was like going over the edge. I prayed. I feel different. I feel like there's a little tiny point of light that's appeared within me. And I can't deny it. And my intellectual side really wanted to deny it. But it was like too true. I had so much despair and fear and arrogance and everything inside that I was struggling with. And this was suddenly kind of... And I didn't see it. I don't know how else to describe it. It was just like a little point of light from outside had come in and appeared in the depths of my darkness. So, you know, a typical biblical thing. I was falling in the pit and God pulled me up. But for me at that moment, it wasn't associated with Christ. It wasn't associated with institutional religion at all. It was just what I call formless grace. It was just, did I deserve it? Nope. Was it given? Yep. Was it given freely? Yep. No strings attached. There wasn't a voice that says, now you need to go do this and do that and go to church every Sunday. It was just a sheer gift to somebody, an undeserving person, was caught in the midst of a dark pit. So for a couple of years, I kind of finished college. I was very leery of heating up my Icarus engine again and getting too full of my own thinking. But I did some different things. I sold real estate in Sacramento and did some things. And then through my relationship with my girlfriend at the time, who's now my wife of more than 40 years, she wanted, we'd been in a relationship, and she had gone away and lived abroad and came back and said, you know, for her it was really important. She realized she wanted a real partner that would share spiritual life, and she was going to get back involved in the Presbyterian church she didn't grown up in San Diego. And she says, you're a nice guy, and I know you had your little spiritual experience, and you don't want to talk to anybody about it. You know, that's all good, but I need to go this other way. So I thought, well, I went to church. My dad showed me how you go to church. You go to church for the women, and you get a bulletin, and you check off how many things are left. But you're acting kind of condescending, and kind of like, I am really above this, but I know you, this is important to you. So I thought, well, let's not end our relationship now. I can go to church with you. That's no big deal. So I went down to her church in San Diego, and it started to be really confusing for me, because the guy who was preaching was not whatever I expected. He was using like T.S. Eliot poetry in the liturgy. He was showing art slides of George Rouault's pictures of Christ and how they developed over time. And there was a level of inquiry. I'm like, I didn't know that was part of faith. Then my wife, I'll just say, not at the time, but said, do you want to go to a Bible study? She says, I'm going to a Bible study. You don't have to go. I just meet you back at the house. And I'm like, oh, I can go to a Bible study now. So I went in there, and there were these people, probably about 8 or 10 people, and they had the Good News Bible, which was pretty trendy back then, and they'd open it up to some passage in John, and they were reading it, and they didn't make a big deal about me being there. They just let me have a seat, and they read the passage, and they just went around and talked about what would that mean for them in their life. And at first I was like, well, I'm not part of this or anything, but after a while I thought, this is really interesting. People are genuinely caring for each other, and really open to something leading them. So, confusion built upon confusion. Cognitive dissonance, you know? So all these stereotypes I had of what it meant to be in a Christian faith were no longer tenable. And I won't go through the whole thing. But by that Christmas, I was down in San Diego, because I was in law school at the time, but I went down to San Diego. And she said, do you want to come along? We're going out with the junior high youth group to sing carols. And I said, oh, yeah, sure, that'd be kind of fun. So we got in the back of this truck, and all these junior high kids going around. And I was reading the sheet with the carols, and it's as if the words of the carols had never been real before. And I said, these are the most beautiful words ever written. And when that happened to me, I'm thinking, something's happened to you. You know, a year ago, these words meant nothing. And it's not like I decided they should mean something to me. It was like my inner life had changed. Not by will, but by grace, you know? So in that, when I started looking back on that experience of mine, that formless grace, like I said, I didn't hear the voice of Jesus. I didn't see Jesus. I didn't have a command to go to church. But as I began to put this together and try to figure it out, I said, well, I read this Bible. This isn't what Jesus does with people. He saves undeserving people. And I'm one of them. You know, I thought I was way above it all. I was not. But I've been lifted up by grace. And I remember saying to that church when things really got went along, I said, I once was lost, and now I'm found. And the search party met here. Because that church, just by no big deal, just by down-to-earth, genuine, listening, caring, just going along with things, just changed my life. So I was saved by formless grace, and I went off then to seminary. I never thought I'd want to be a minister, but I was interested in theology. I got to Princeton Seminary, and it was all so new to me and so exciting. And at that time, if I think about Trinity, God is creator, you know, interesting, but not compelling. Spirit, I'm not sure what to make of that, but it's all about Jesus. I didn't know anything about Jesus. I want to figure out everything I can. So, like, for the 3 years there, you know, all these classes and everything went to and studied Greek and all that. And I loved it. It was just endlessly fascinating. The problem is that it's Princeton Seminary was a place that valued critical thinking above all else. And looking back, not much of the life of the Spirit or the mystery, the kind of what Rohr talks about, because it was all about wanting to be like a great German university. And one of a funny story to me, some of you may know a great Catholic priest who was involved in healing ministry for many years, Francis McNutt. Some of you have known his work, right? So he was going to be coming through New Jersey, and so some people at the seminary wanted to invite him to come and speak at the seminary. But the seminary administration wasn't quite sure if they wanted a healer to come speak. So they decided he could come and talk, but he couldn't do any healing. So that was like, you know, because that would be kind of weird. Even if somebody really needs it, I would rather have my clean and clear cognitive categories that are really safe, because that's, I don't know what that is. That's something different, you know. It's not something different, but it's different than the cognitive thinking. So I didn't really, I just loved the seminary and anything else. I didn't realize at the time that there wasn't as much Holy Spirit in it. It was a lot of academics and mastering the concept of Jesus and good Presbyterian theology. So then I went to Santa Paula and went to San Francisco Theological Seminary for the contemplative retreat. I don't know why I went to a contemplative retreat. They didn't say that seminary, you should do that. But when I went there, the world of the inner life opened up. And Carl Jung, which a lot of you know, I had never heard of him much. And I went off and read his Memories, Dreams, Reflections. And it wasn't that he had great spiritual insight, but just the idea that there's this huge inner imaginative world that we live in, which when we open to it and then we look at Scripture and we listen to people's stories and the dreams people have and spiritual insights people have, this is really helpful stuff of how do we think and live through symbols and metaphors and archetypes and all that kind of stuff. And it really opened up a lot of wonderful things for me in Scripture. And I started going to St. Andrew's Priory. Some of you may know St. Andrew's Priory, the Benedictine monastery out in Pear Blossom. Yay! Great, great, great place, you know. And so with those monks out there and reading and learning how to be in silence, it was like the world of the Spirit was kind of coming. Because it's not just about reading and understanding things, but it's experiencing. There's one of the Psalms, the New English Bible, as it quotes one of the Psalms, as saying, "In the night, my inmost self instructs me." You know, and the sense that at night, in when we're not awake and alert and analyzing things, there's something in us that's trying to teach us. You know, there's perhaps a part of us on our own, but certainly the Spirit, God's Spirit, which we may not see in any shape or form coming, but it's there, seeking to instruct us. So that was very helpful to me. Anyway, so from Santa Paula, we decided to go to be volunteers in mission up in Wapato, Washington, which is one of the, these days and was then, one of the poorest towns in Washington State. But we went to live on a 40-acre apple farm that was a retreat center that youth groups would come and adult groups would come, some groups from Whitworth and other places would come. And we talk about creation in terms of modern understanding and land stewardship and all those things. And so suddenly, to be out in long alfalfa fields and changing irrigation lines, having been a suburban kid, I'd never been near agriculture. And the creation, so now I'm going to move to God as creator, that whole sense of the extraordinary beauty and harshness of creation. And it really helped me go back to some of those earliest human religious impulses when you're out there and you're vulnerable and you're around all of this. I remember one of my jobs the first year was to feed, we had a big steer, a big beef cow, who we were feeding. So my job in the morning was to take corn and move it over and then give it to this bull. And that bull would come over and he would know that corn was coming. And he would come, and he got bigger and bigger, of course, every week. And honestly, the ground would shake a bit by the time he got over 1,000 pounds by the time he'd get close. And I would just sit there. I was a San Bernardino kid. I'm like, wow, that's a big apple. And then it came time in the winter for that bull to be slaughtered. So they called the local butcher. It's rural areas, normal, right? Came out in a big truck. Came out and took a rifle as the cow came over and boom, just, you know, no pain, it's gone. And he cut the head off of the beef, the steer, and kind of tossed it into his truck and then got ready to start pulling it up on a winch. And it was snowy and the blood of this steer was going into the snow and steaming. And I was like, wow, I've never been around that. Now, you think of our ancestors, our rural, I mean, not too long ago, rural life, totally normal. But I had been so cut off from that. And in that moment, I understood the whole thing of animal sacrifice. Not that we want to do it, but I mean, in the Bible, there's all kinds of things about sacrificing doves and oxen and sheep. And I thought, even if we don't theologically, you know, go that way anymore, I can understand, because you're at the boundary of life and death. This 1,000-pound animal is suddenly gone. And we all live on that boundary. And that's scary. So I want to kind of make peace. You know, I mean, that's an ancient, almost universal kind of impulse to be around that. So that was something they didn't teach, you know, seriously. That's something they didn't teach me at Princeton. Not something that I learned at Palermo. But the rural area taught me that. I remember taking a train to back here for holidays, and I was reading a good book, The Denial of Death by Ernest Becker. Some of you may remember that. You know, a real strong book about how it's a kind of a Freudian view on why we deny death. And Becker is writing, he's Austrian, I think, or Viennese, whatever, and saying, I remember one time he said, the man's ultimate thing he has to deal with is that he defecates. That's like the big crisis of our life. I'm like, not if you're on a farm, you know. I mean, that's just called manure, you know. But I mean, it really, that having been in the creation, out there, really kind of got the academic city kid a little out of me. Well, no, it didn't. I mean, it just hopefully broadened a little bit, and to see the farmers that were my parishioners, and go through tough crop cycles, and how much they love the land. And how much they loved their trees, and respected each other, and helped each other. I mean, it was a powerful thing of creation. Just tell you one little story. When I was being called to the church there, the pastoral nominating committee, about eight in somebody's living room, and there was a farmer named Howard Munson who wore big overalls and very quiet guy. And as we're talking about an hour into the interview, we're talking about bilingual education and something, and then Howard finally speaks up. And everybody looks, because Howard usually doesn't talk, and he says, I'm bilingual. One kind of language I use at church, and one kind I use at home. and that was his only statement. But that's not fancy stuff, you know? But that's, I knew Howard. I mean, I'd been around his family. I'd baptized his grandkids. That kind of just down-to-earth reality. It's based in creation. You know, it's not in a book. It's not in a book. The books maybe help us or hinder us from being open to it. So for me, being there for six, almost 7 years, was about fecundity of the land, harshness, about winter, death, poverty, but also fidelity. Fidelity that so many people have to the land there. That goes. It's not a job. The earth is their heart. Just real quick, during that time, I was struggling to understand the Trinity theology, and I came across process theology, which some of you may be familiar with. And this ended up being really helpful to me, and I'm going to qualify it after I explain it. I'm sure some of you know quite a bit about it, others maybe not so much, based on the philosophy of Alfred North Whitehead. But it's an interesting thing, just to posit, that traditionally God's been talked about as omnipresent, is there everywhere, omniscient, knows everything, and omnipotent, ultimate power over everything. And process theology kind of speculates, what if the power isn't omnipotent power in that outside down kind of power that we think of, but more alluring, a possibilities of lying, putting out in front of creation as it goes along. And that God's lure pervades all matter. We're certainly in us, work of the Spirit, but it's certainly throughout biological life and in varying degrees, and just very tiny to maybe infinitesimal, but it's present everywhere. And God is calling all of creation towards its greatest potential, including each one of us. God is incarnate in the lives of all people when they act according to a call from God. So that little lure is that inmost self, perhaps, at night or in the day, asking us, nudging us to do what's right, to do something more. And insofar as we, following that, God's becoming incarnate in our life. Jesus, in this sense, is not necessarily a completely other being created in some completely unrelated way to humanity. But Jesus is the one person who has fully and in every way responded to God's call, and thus the person of Jesus is the divine word in human form. So that Jesus, from his earliest moments, when he'd hear that call, he would follow it. And when he heard it, he followed it. And as he did, he got filled with healing power, power for exorcism, and God just kept, as he kept following God as a human, God kept filling him with God's presence. So he became the Word. And so Jesus is not singularly or essentially God, but he was perfectly synchronized to God at all moments of his life. This kind of a thing. So for me, intellectually, when I would go back and try to figure out all this stuff, having lived on the farm, this was kind of making sense to me. And I got excited about it. But what happened is kind of a turning point in my life. What happened is, but at that point, if I had read something really great about the Bible or whatever, or a psychology, it was really important to me that if somebody came to me with an issue, that I would really want to tell them this exciting new intellectual way to look at whatever they're going on in their life. So I spent time with John Cobb. I got to know process theology. And then people would come to me in the midst of tragedy in their life, and I'd say, well, you know, one way to think about it is that God isn't omnipotent anyway. And sometimes they would just look at me like, aren't you supposed to be a pastor? I mean, and not in the bad, it's like, this isn't helpful. This is some conceptual stuff for me, you know? And there's a moment when I just said, what I'm called to be is to think about these things, but ultimately I'm called to be people's pastor, not an expert on the latest intellectual trend that I'm reading. And that intellectual trend stuff is fascinating. I always want to follow up with it, but in the end, it's put the books aside and just be with people and figure out what it is that they need. So I went, how are we doing here? Keep going? Okay, great. So toward the end of that time, I went through a depression, midlife depression, good old midlife depression, because I was feeling that my professional life was kind of at a dead end. I kind of wanted to get out of parish ministry to something else. And I remember one time in prayer, like Aurora would say, trying to seek that communion and trying to imagine approaching God. And in my imagination, what appeared was this shiny stainless steel vault door that was closed. And I was standing in front of it. I was like, there was no handle, there was no combination, just a big steel door. And so I went through months of hiding it from my congregation, and my wife could kind of sense that I wasn't right. But in Seattle, I went one Sunday, I happened to be in Seattle, and I went to a Quaker service and sat in a Quaker service. And a week before, I'd been at a Mass where the priest giving the Mass in a little chapel was preaching on Jesus when he says, take my yoke upon you. And in his homily, he was saying, you know, Jesus was a carpenter, and in those days, they didn't mass produce yokes. So in a little village like Nazareth, if Jesus or his father was going to create a yoke, they would fit it to the cow that they was going to be pulling it. They would measure it and then create it to fit. And he said, thus God calls each of us to fits our yoke to us. It's not a mass manufactured yokes that get passed out. It fits us. So that was kind of in the back of my mind. I went to that Quaker service in Seattle. And as you know, some of you may be a Quaker background. It was the Spirit, you know. Where is the Spirit in me, and is it there anywhere? And where the Spirit is, Christ is there. So I sat there just kind of meditating. And then this image unfolded of seeing that steel door. And suddenly it kind of melted and turned into a kind of lightweight titanium into a perfectly fitting yoke. And went on my shoulders, and I was like, and then there was a garden. And I was like, I like it. You know, it was like this turning point in my depression. And that's the work of the Spirit. The Spirit working in my individual little psyche, like it does in all of our psyches, working with the images and the stuff of my life to try to help me resolve something that I was enduring and going on to somewhere else. So even though I'd planned to leave the parish ministry, Galita Perez and I had been in contact, and then they ended up offering me the call, and I did know if I wanted to take it, because I was thinking, I'm kind of done with parish ministry. And so I prayed about it one morning at my church, little town. I prayed about it really hard. God, you know I want to get out of this church work, but tell me what to do. And that afternoon, I was up in the floor of the Sunday school building, and these words came. Don't be afraid. Trust in the Holy Spirit. All will be well. And I was like, darn it, that means I'm staying in the church. But it was like, it was clear. It was like, don't be afraid. Trust in the Spirit. So the Spirit then became, if Jesus had, and Jesus is always there, but Jesus had been my... Earlier, I really wanted to figure that out. Went to the farm to really figure out the creation kind of thing. This was a real call to follow into the Spirit. And so I went to Galita Perez, and I stayed there. I thought I was going to be there 5 years, stayed there 16. And even though I loved to keep reading, like I said, by that time I was like, I'm not going to read if it gets in the way of people, my connection with people. I'd interviewed once a Calvary Chapel pastor who had left the Presbyterian Church because he said Presbyterians are spirit phobic. They're afraid of the Holy Spirit. He said, if you go into a Presbyterian church and you're a visitor, their first question is, what committee can we put this person on? He says, but I want to know, where is the Spirit working in this person's life, and how can I help that process go along? And I was like, we do have committee needs, but that was an interesting way to look at it. And one of my preaching teachers in seminary, I might have quoted this to you before, said, when you're preaching and you're preparing, don't think you're creating a rose that on Sunday morning you're going to hold up so everybody can admire it, and on the way out they say, wow, you've done a great job. He says, think of your preaching as compost. You're creating compost that goes out into people's lives, and what you're looking for is the growth coming out of their lives. That's the prize. Not, is the sermon a beautiful, beautiful rose, but what's happening in the lives of the people. So for me, I think one reason why I was so blessed to be at Galita Perez is it was that point in my life, in terms of Trinity, where Spirit was really becoming, I believed in it. I believed that it's in all everybody's hearts, and our job as a church is to help discern that and make way for the Spirit to lead each person wherever they need to be. If they want to be led to a committee, that's really good, because we need committees. But if they have some other vision of where God might be leading them, our job is to listen and think about it so that we're more tending God's field rather than just creating our own factory of what we want. So, I can finish up here, just real quick. Went to Hospice Santa Barbara. Trinity. What Trinity Hospice Santa Barbara? Hospice, I went from being a People thought I was a pastor at first, and they were kind of, some of them distrusted me because they didn't know what I was going to try to do to their organization. But after a while, they figured, oh, he's okay. He's not gonna make us into something we don't want to be. But what was interesting for me is the way Trinity came into that work. Let's do creation. Sometimes when people are dying or grieving, nature plays a profound role in their healing. Some of you may know Eileen Bunning, who was the director of Visiting Nurse and Hospice Care, and they created Serenity House. It was really important for Eileen when they were designing that to be able to have patients look out on nature, not on hospital walls, not on television screens, but nature, sun, wind, those things moving. And I know one patient, she told me once, said, could you tell the gardener not to sweep up the leaves that have fallen? Because they're beautiful too. Could he just leave those outside my window? You know? So nature, creation, teaches us in different ways. And I know for some people that's a primary way to teach. In terms of Jesus, early on I was called to help with a patient who was dying. And she says, well, she really wants to see a pastor, but she's ashamed of what's happened in her life, so she doesn't want to see anybody that knows her. So would you go see her? So I said, absolutely. So we talked, and she'd had a lot of drug problems. And she said, you know, what's really hard for me is that I don't deserve to be saved by Jesus. And I said, you realize that when you say that, that's exactly what it's all about? Is that none of us deserve it? That's what Jesus does, is saves people that don't deserve it. And boom, we had that connection. So that grace of Jesus came into play sometimes, overtly in that work. And then the spirit of really believing that every person that came through that door, just like churches, everybody's, the spirit's there wanting to draw us forward to authentic connection. And in this postmodern world that we're in, sometimes we're not sure what to trust anymore. And sometimes things people believed when they were children, they're not sure when they're going through grief or facing dying, those things are still there. But I believe each one of those people, every human being, has that in them. And our job at hospice was to just make space to help them find what was real for them. And that's not shallow. That's real. And one of the things I felt particularly grateful for we did at Hospice Santa Barbara is we created a spiritual care counseling team that went into nursing homes where there was a lot of depression and would sit with people to work through what was going on. Because most nursing homes, I know friends of mine are administrators and everything, it's a tough business. But most of the staff doesn't have the time or the skill to really work with somebody's pain and their questioning over time in a way that isn't just let's medicate them or turn the TV back on, to really sit with that and negotiate with it. But when it goes through there and that spirit has some hospitality in front of it, just kind of like the little Trinitarian table there, then the spirit is really able to bring that person often to some clarity in the midst of some very difficult things. So even... Okay, last one, and then we'll take a break. This is the Casa de Maria. So that's where I am now. Casa de Maria. It's saturated with the Spirit. People feel it of all kinds come there. And Mary's there. Maybe we'll talk about that later. This is the last thing I'll say, and then we'll take the break. As I said, we're working on doing nonprofit leadership support for people to come to La Casa to learn, to experience their own personal renewal when they're doing great work in the world for social justice and other things. And in May, we did a thing at the Stonehouse at that beautiful Center for Spiritual Renewal. And the Weingart Foundation sent five immigration people from Los Angeles up, who they said, these are the most burned out people we know right now since the election. So we're going to send them to La Casa. You guys take care of them. And we did. And when we got there, that first night, there was a woman... We said, okay, what's bringing you all here? And this is where I'll end for our break. What brings you all here? And this one woman said, I don't believe in signs. But I guess there have been a lot of signs in my life because everybody says I'm grumpy. Everybody uses the same word. You're so grumpy. You need to get away. And I got mad at them. Maybe grumpier to have them tell me I'm grumpy. But the more I heard about it from people, my coworkers, people that cared about me, I thought, well, maybe I do need to go to one of these damn retreat things. She said she drove up from L.A., grumpy, and she pulled into the gates of La Casa de Maria, like those gates, and a huge smile came over her, and she had no idea why it had come over her. And she pulled over because she said she was so astounded to have this huge smile on her. She says, I'm telling you this, she was saying to Catherine and me, I'm telling you this because if somebody reports they saw a strange lady smiling and parked in her car, it was me last night. But I feel so different just being here. So let's take a break.